Okay, well, hello everyone to this sort of like special interdisciplinary seminar today for everyone from like quantum information theorists to quantum matter people to string theorists. Yeah, we're excited to have Ash Milstead here, who's going to tell us about, well, I guess some of you know him. I just got to know him. And he's going to tell us about how to simulate false vacuum bubble collisions and on spin chains. So please take it away.
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me to give one of your seminars. It's nice to be virtually back at PI. So this is going to be about some work that was done over the past year or so with grad student Junyu Liu at Caltech and John Presco and Giffre Vidal. Giffre is at X or some other Alphabet subsidiary these days. So it's about collisions of false vacuum bubble walls, as Dominic was saying. And I'll first explain what I mean roughly by that in case it's unfamiliar. So there's this idea of the false vacuum, which can be thought of in terms of, say, an effective potential for a quantum field. So imagine that this is the effective potential energy, and there are maybe two or more configurations that have equal energy. Well, this is what you have in the case of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So if there's a spontaneously broken symmetry, there are usually multiple vacua with the same energy. Now, false vacuum is when there's some shift in this potential, which means that some of these vacua are no longer vacua, their energies get raised, and some of these vacua remain vacua. So we'll consider a Z2 symmetry, in which case there'll be one true vacuum and one false vacuum, but there could in principle be multiple instances of each. So this is an explicitly broken symmetry, Z2 in this case. A classic example can be built in scalar field theory, Phi-4 theory, if you like. Now, there can be processes if for some reason your system gets stuck in a false vacuum or is initialized in a false vacuum through some process. There are processes which can take you from the false vacuum to the true vacuum, such as a quantum tunneling process. And if this happens, say, locally at a certain point in space-time, let's imagine your field theory describes the space-time you're living in, then what that means is that some small bubble of true vacuum will form. And because the false vacuum has a higher energy density than the true vacuum, it's energetically favorable for the bubble of true vacuum that just formed to expand, and the energy of the false vacuum gets turned into kinetic energy of the bubble walls. The walls accelerate and approach the speed of light, and the false vacuum is replaced with the true vacuum in a rather catastrophic fashion. So if your false vacuum described the universe you knew, then the true vacuum appearing at some location and spreading out at the speed of light is a pretty disastrous event. And there's some possibility that depending on your assumptions. So if you assume that the standard model describes our universe well, then you can do some calculations and apparently get a result that we may actually be in a metastable false vacuum state that just lasts a very long time before ultimately decaying to the true vacuum. But yeah, that we can leave to one side because we're not going to be considering the standard model in this work, but it's part of the motivation. But we'll be considering a much simpler, say, 1+1 dimensional setting where a bubble kind of looks like this. If there's some pattern of field configurations on a line, then a bubble is some area where the field configuration is different. So we're going to imagine that we actually are left with a small bubble of false vacuum. So you can imagine after some bubbles of true vacuum have formed in your universe that was originally in the false vacuum, well, these true vacuum bubbles expand and eventually their walls collide with each other and whatever is left of the false vacuum in the middle gets swallowed up in the process. So we're imagining that there's true vacuum on the outside, on the left and right here, and there's some false vacuum remaining in the middle, and these walls are rushing towards each other and they're going to collide. And some stuff will happen when this collision happens. Presumably some particles will be created. And what we'd like to understand is to what extent can we compute these dynamics of a collision of two false vacuum bubble walls, including whatever particle production takes place. So obviously the standard model is just way too hard to simulate. It's a very complicated interacting quantum field theory. You could go to a simpler field theory, such as 5-4 theory that I mentioned before. And in 1 plus 1 dimensions, that's relatively easy to deal with. You can do, it's an interacting QFD still, so you'll still see some particle production generically. And you can do some perturbative calculations at weak coupling, but not at strong couplings. And it's still a field theory, so really you'd to do numerical simulations and get away from weak coupling, you want to put it on a lattice or regulate it some other way that makes it amenable to simulation. So if you put it on the lattice, you get some lattice 5-4 theory, which is something like a chain of bosonic particles. You can do then numerical simulations, say with tensor network methods, matrix product states. But you have to truncate the bosonic modes in order to do that. So that's kind of an additional approximation you have to throw in there. So we're going even simpler than that. We're going to take some spin chain which already has a finite Hilbert space on each lattice site, say a chain of qubits, where we can do the tensor network simulations. We don't need to worry about additional truncation. And we can access some continuum physics by tuning the spin chain close to criticality, so close to some interesting critical point, where on one side of the critical point, we have some spontaneous symmetry breaking. And then we add an extra field to explicitly break the symmetry and get to the false vacuum scenario. And we think that looking here will be a good place to look for potential applications of near-term noisy intermediate scale quantum devices, which might have, say, 100 or so qubits that you can play around with and do a simulation with at relatively short times. And part of why we're doing this work is to understand how far you would have to go to beat classical methods. So this is the classical side of the puzzle. We want to see what we think are the best classical methods for doing this can do and how far they can take us, with a view to finding where they're no longer good enough and where you would want a quantum device to take over or potentially another method. So spin chains is where we're focusing. So in a spin chain, you have some discretized version of what I showed you before. Now, say your spins can be either aligned up or down. And in the true vacuum, say they're aligned up, and in the false vacuum, they're down. And if you've got a bubble of false vacuum, the wall, like a domain wall in between the two, will rush into the false vacuum. And here we've got two walls rushing towards each other again, and they'll collide and produce presumably some quasi-particles of the spin chain. So our project is to construct first good false vacuum bubbles. I'll explain what I mean by good false vacuum bubbles later. Simulate their collapse in real time. And we're going to use infinite matrix product states to do that. We want to characterize, if possible, the emergent continuum physics near a phase transition, avoiding lattice effects as far as we can. And we'd like to understand the computational requirements for doing this. In particular, how far can we take these MPS methods? So here are some results, a summary of what we have managed to do. We managed to create stable bubble wall wave packets so that if you create your initial false vacuum bubble, it does what I just said. The walls rush towards each other with nothing else happening except for them perhaps accelerating. Until they collide, and then there's some scattering event, some particle production event. So creating stable bubble walls that do not just immediately decay into lighter particles is not totally trivial. So that's one thing. We found that if you then look at the collisions of such, or the collapse of such bubbles in the Ising model, the transverse field Ising model, even with a field that breaks integrability, which you need in order to break the symmetry and get the false vacuum, we see elastic collisions to very high precision. So we don't see any evidence of particle production there. And then if we go to an extended model with some extra interaction terms, some three-body terms in this case, we can indeed get to a place where we can see like production of particles, particle pairs, inelastic scattering events, in other words. And we analyze with a view to figuring out how far we can push these simulations. We analyze the entanglement production because it's the entanglement that limits the computational requirements, that determines the computational requirements of the MPS computation. So if there's lots of entanglement, the calculation will become harder to do. So we want to know how entanglement scales, say, with the energy of the walls, or let's say their velocity when they collide. And we've found that we need to go to relatively large systems, at least for the system that we looked at, the Hamiltonian model that we looked at, in order to avoid significant wave packet spread and delocalization of the bubble walls and the outgoing particles and so on and so forth. Okay, so unless there are any questions already at this point, I'll go on to tell you a little bit about the methods we're using here.
Can I ask a quick question?
Of course.
So you said that you break integrability with a new term, right? This cubic interaction or three-body interaction. Could you just increase the magnetic field or... If you increase much more the magnetic field, probably we'll see particle production or not.
Probably at some point, but the difficulty is increasing the magnetic field and still being able to find a false vacuum state that is metastable. So we want finding the false vacuum is tricky because, of course, it has this huge energy gap to the true vacuum. So numerically, what we can do is we can take the true vacuum and flip all the spins. That gets us somewhere close to the false vacuum, but it doesn't give us a stable state itself. We then have to perform an extra sort of energy reduction procedure, a cooling procedure, if you like, which gets us to a truly stable or at least metastable false vacuum. And the problem is that if we increase the symmetry breaking field too much, then that just becomes very difficult to do with the methods we're using. Now, I don't know if that's a fundamental problem, if it's difficult to do using all methods. At some point, presumably, there's no longer really a sense in which you have a false vacuum, but I don't know when we hit that point. But certainly, there seems to be a limit to how far you want to go with the symmetry breaking field. And really, go on.
No, go ahead, finish.
Well, I was going to say, the other thing is that certainly it's true that if you want to approach the critical point, say in the Ising model, you have to tune both the transverse field and the longitudinal field to zero. Now, of course, you can decide what ratio they ought to have along that path, but they both have to approach zero if you want to take a continuum limit.
Right, and when you fix that ratio, then you can change between different integrable theories. In particular, if you just have magnetic field, right, you go to this EA theory of Zamolodchikov.
Yes, right.
Would that one be possible to study, or that would be impossible because the vacuum there is too complicated?
I think we can study that too. It's just that I don't know if it fits into the false vacuum scenario, but I don't see why we couldn't study scattering in that setting of other excitations. And perhaps it's possible to get the false vacuum setup going there too. But certainly we could, I don't see why we couldn't study particle scattering in that situation.
Okay, I'll wait to see how you cook up this particle and then I'll ask again. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I have one quick question. Is that your problem of making the false vacuum bubbles stable, has that to do with the fact that these kink excitations are not topological in a simple spin chain? If you would do that in a Sine-Gordon model, they would be topological, and then the vacuum bubble would be stable. But it's a continuous model then. But it can be implemented experimentally.
Well, let me see if I understand. So if you don't have the symmetry breaking field, then say in the Ising model, you in the spontaneously symmetry broken phase, you have topological excitations. Which are the kinks, and they are stable. If you like, the fermions under a Jordan-Wigner transformation, in case that helps. So they're stable, at least in the situation where the symmetry breaking is turned off. And when you turn on the field, well, they're stable insofar as the false vacuum is stable. So if the false vacuum is metastable, then I guess they're metastable topological excitation. Okay. All right. But you know, it's a separate issue as to can your numerical methods find a good false vacuum state from whether it exists, of course. Okay, so let me go on towards describing the methods a little. So to do all this, we need first to understand and to be able to represent the true and the false vacua. And we need to be able to represent walls between true and false vacuum to make our bubble. So we're going to use tensor network methods to do this, matrix product states in particular. And in case you're not familiar, I'm going to very briefly explain what these are. So let's consider a quantum state for a many-body system with three bodies. So here's some, it could be qubits, for example, three qubits. Here's some state for this three-qubit system, a general state with coefficients psi ijk. Now, we can draw this using a tensor network notation. This is just another way of writing this this object with three indices. So we draw it as a blob, and we have three legs connected to the blob, each one representing the basis states of one of the qubits in the system. Okay, so this is a tensor for this state. So we use this notation to draw tensor network diagrams. And a matrix product state is simply a way of decomposing this blob tensor for a general state into a tensor for each site, for each qubit. So we decompose this tensor into a tensor network of three different tensors, one for each qubit. And we have an index called a virtual index or a bond index connecting each tensor with its neighbor. Now, you can always decompose a psi in this way, as long as you choose these bond dimensions large enough. Now it becomes an efficient way to deal with quantum states when the bond dimensions don't have to be very large, and then you can do efficient computations with matrix product states. And these bond dimensions determine in a very direct way the kind of entanglement that you can have between different qubits or different sites in the system. So with a small bond dimension corresponds to fewer terms in the Schmidt decomposition if you take a cut across that bond, in case that helps. Okay, so that's our notation for a matrix product state. I'm going to sort of draw it in this fairly abstract way, just a string of blobs connected in this way. And these are the bonds of dimension chi, let's say. And these bottom legs, again, represent the spins in the spin chain, or the qubits, or the lattice sites, if you like. Now, most operations you can do with these matrix product states incur a cost that's polynomial in the bond dimension. In particular, it goes as chi to the cubed, chi 3. And as I was saying, the entanglement, you can also think about the effect of the bond dimension in terms of the von Neumann entropy. The von Neumann entropy is less than or equal to log of chi if you take if you take your subsystem for computing the entropy as the left part of the system, or equivalently the right part of the system, according to this cut. Okay, so we're going to represent the vacua and the true and the false vacua as infinite matrix product states, where you just have an infinite chain of these tensors. You can minimize the energy within this subset of states by optimizing the parameters of these tensors, and that's indeed how we find the true vacuum state, or at least an approximation to it. And since we're not at a critical point, it turns out you can usually find a moderate bond dimension for which you can get a good approximation to the true vacuum. We find the false vacuum, as I mentioned, by taking the true vacuum, flipping all of the spins, and then minimizing the energy again using a sort of cooling procedure. And This is currently what limits how large the symmetry breaking field can be in our numerics, because the cooling procedure will fail and ultimately take you to the true vacuum if the field is large enough. So we've got the vacua. Now we need the bubble walls or the kinks. Now, one way of making a false vacuum bubble, which I'll mention up front, is you could just take the true vacuum and you could flip all the spins in some subregion of the lattice. So you could just flip all the spins in the middle, for example, by applying sigma x on all of those spins. And that would give you some kind of false vacuum bubble. Obviously, this false vacuum is not the cooled false vacuum that I talked about previously, but it's close to it. And so why not just use states like this? One reason is that these bubble walls are very UV objects. You know, they are as focused in space, as localized in space as they possibly could be, and will have in general quite a large energy. Now you can mitigate that somewhat. You can smear them out in space, which gives them some focus in momentum as well. You can then give them some sort of localized momentum and keep them reasonably localized in space. That will reduce the energy, but still typically, such bubble walls will not be stable. They will contain multiple types of particle, quasi-particle of the system, both topological and non-topological quasi-particles of the system. And so if you create such a state, you'll immediately see particles flying away from these bubble walls. And you don't really want to have to simulate those if you can avoid them. So because they create additional entanglement and they make the simulation harder. So using a string in this way will generally create unstable walls with relatively high energy. So instead of doing this, we're going to take a matrix product state ansatz for a kink or a domain wall, and we're going to build it by using the tensors we already found for the true vacuum MPS and the false vacuum MPS. And then we allow some tensor in the middle, which is supposed to parameterize the wall, to vary, and we optimize it in some way.
Sorry, can I ask a question? So here, yes. The blue and the black, and the blue and the red tensors are very simple because the vacuum is just spin up or spin down there, right?
Well, the vacuum is not is close to that, but not quite, because we have some transverse field, say, in the Ising model, and so there are fluctuations on the vacuum too.
If I were to apply to but I wanted to know if this is still true. Imagine I wanted to apply this to, say, spin-ons, so excitations around antiferromagnetic vacuum.
Okay.
Could I still do the following? Compute first the vacuum, then
yes,
using these tensors, find what the blue box is, right? And mm-hmm. then use the blue box everywhere except in this green dot. And in the green dot, it will be the spin-on.
Yes, yes, indeed. You can certainly do that. And people have certainly done it. So it's it actually goes back to 97 at least. There's a paper by Romer and Ostlund where they consider this type of ansatz for excitations on top of just a uniform vacuum. So you take the true vacuum everywhere except for one of these tensors, and then you actually form momentum eigenstates from these by building the superposition of these states. And it turns out you can construct an effective Hamiltonian within that space, and you can solve it, and you get some, and I think it was Hagemann, Michalakis, Frustrator, Nachtigala probably in 2013 showed that this sort of ansatz gives you an exponentially good approximation of gapped excitations if they're not, you know, below threshold excitations. If they're not above the two particle threshold in your system, then you can get an exponentially good approximation to these quasi particles using this ansatz. So we certainly didn't invent this idea. We're just using it in this false vacuum setting. I guess that's the main novelty of what we're doing with this type of ansatz. And indeed, the idea of using it to construct localized wave packets that you can then evolve in time was also explored last year by Martin van Dam, Jutta Hagemann, and Frank Verstrater of Ghent. Okay. So anyway, but this, I hope that answered the question. This ansatz then sort of looks like this. You've got like the true vacuum, if you consider the spin expectation values, you've got the true vacuum on one side of this green tensor, then you've got something parameterized by this green tensor in the middle, and then this will asymptote again to the false vacuum as you go away from the green tensor. So how do you choose this green tensor? Well, you can, as I was just describing, build momentum eigenstates by taking the superposition of these states at all different positions. And if you want to add a momentum, you can add a coefficient like this. And then you can solve an effective Hamiltonian in that space to find what is effectively a quasi-particle, a topological quasi-particle of the system. Now, this is a little bit more subtle where you have a false vacuum, because of course the true and the false vacuum have different energy densities, but you can still build a certain a type of effective Hamiltonian for which these topological excitations are momentum eigenstates, and that gives you something which it turns out behaves in the right way. So in the sense that if you construct these excitations, you do this optimization, you find you have bubble walls which are stable and propagate as they should. At least up to some numerical error. And out of this procedure, you can also get a dispersion relation for these type of topological particles or for non-topological particles if you had true vacuum on both sides. And so you can understand something about how wave packets will behave, as well as where the energy thresholds are for particle production and so on and so forth. Okay, so building wave packets, well, how do you do that? You can take these green tensor states, which have some excitation at location J, and rather than building the momentum eigenstates, you can use some other packet function, Fj, and we'll just consider Gaussian packets where you have some Gaussian localized in space with some finite width. So here's the packet function. And this is going to mean your wave packet will have some support on the dispersion relation for this particle, and how big the support is in momentum space will depend on how broad the packet is in real space, of course, according to the Fourier transform. So if we make our packets reasonably broad, we'll focus in momentum space. And actually, we want to focus in momentum space because this will reduce the spread of the wave packet in the dynamical spread of the wave packet in simulations. And we want things to remain reasonably localized because that makes it easier to characterize the outcomes of these collisions. Okay, so we now have states describing these bubble walls, which we built from the true and false vacuum tensors of the MPS by optimizing an additional tensor in the middle that goes in the middle. So the initial state for our simulation is a bubble consisting of a kink and an anti-kink tensor with false vacuum in the middle and true vacuum on the outside. And I've added some wave packet functions F and G describing the wave packets for the kink and the anti-kink respectively. So the green tensor on the left represents the kink, the green tensor on the right represents the anti-kink, and we've chosen them using this optimization ansatz to be the topological quasi-particles of lowest energy in our simulations. Although in principle, if there are other excitations available below threshold, we can use those too. And then after we've constructed this state, we apply time evolution. And the particular method we use is a variation on the time-dependent variational principle, including some ability to increase the bond dimension of the MPS as the evolution continues in order to account for entanglement that is produced during the simulation. And we do this within a finite window of the infinite chain so that we can avoid boundary effects, at least up until the simulation hits the wall of the finite window. And in principle, you can expand the window in order to continue the simulation beyond that point. So as the state is evolving, we expect particles to be produced, and we'd like to be able to characterize what is produced. So we do that by taking overlaps with these quasi-particle states that I've already described for the kink and the anti-kink. So we could, for example, detect how much of the state is in a kink anti-kink configuration, in other words, a false vacuum bubble, as time proceeds. So the initial state is, of course, built from these kink anti-kink position states. But after the first collision, if some particles are produced, then the amplitude for these kink anti-kink states will go down, and the amplitude for some other types of particle quasi-particle states will go up. So, for example, you might produce a single meson or meson, or perhaps a pair of mesons. And again, this is what Pedro was talking about. Of course, you can also find these topologically trivial excitations, as I mentioned before, by minimizing the energy of some effective Hamiltonian. Okay, and it's important when considering these states with multiple excitations that because we found these green tensors for single particle states, they don't account for interactions. So what we have to do in practice is take overlaps with these states where we set some minimum separation for the green tensors. That means that we avoid misrepresenting what happens when the two particles get too close. What I mean is that you'd have to, in general, change the green tensors as the particles approach each other to account for interaction effects. And of course, in a case where particle production can occur, ultimately, that interaction will produce some new particles. And we don't want to have to describe that complete process by constructing a very complicated basis. It's enough if we can describe particles when they're well separated from each other, when they're indeed well defined.
So just a comment. So the mass of the meson is it's smaller than the mass of A plus B, right? The mesons are the stable particles.
Right. So indeed. So the meson, the single meson is the single meson of lowest energy. So of course, again, we can potentially find mesons with a series of energies, but the single meson of lowest energy is the lowest energy non-topological excitation. And of course, a pair of mesons, if they're well separated, has roughly twice that energy, and so on and so forth.
You could scatter mesons as well. Forget about kinks and just scatter mesons, right?
Yes.
And when the mesons scatter, they could produce one meson plus a pair of kink and anti-kink and stuff like this.
Indeed. And if you want to, if you want to see some examples of scattering in elastic set, if you want to see some examples of elastic scattering of scalar particles or mesons, then you can look at this earlier work from last year by Van Damme and Verstrater and Hagerman.
I would be interested in seeing non-elastic scattering, right? So what would be interesting to hear about.
Yeah. Well, we were interested in that too. So we were happy that we were able to see that in this setting. And there's no reason why you couldn't also see it by scattering two mesons. Yeah. Just to stress that.
Did you try just scattering the mesons and measuring elasticity, or you were focused mostly on the...
Well, we were focused on phosphate, but we did try a few experiments. So one thing we did try was we tried to scatter mesonic excitations on top of the false vacuum, because we thought that might shed some light on how true vacuum bubbles can form. You can have some metastable scalar excitations on top of the false vacuum, and you might think that if two of those scatter, then they could produce a small bubble of true vacuum that then expands. So we have looked at that, and indeed there are clearly inelastic outcomes of that process. I guess I don't know if we looked at it on top of the true vacuum, but I am certain that that also works, and you will see some inelastic outcomes.
Okay, I'll ask you more about that later then.
Okay. Let's just briefly look at, I've said a lot about the model already, but let's just briefly go over what it looks like. So, you know, a minimal spin chain for investigating these kind of phenomena, you need to have at least one false vacuum. And you'd like to ideally have inelastic scattering of your bubble walls so that you see some interesting particle production. So this is the model we looked at. It's the transverse field Ising model with ZZ nearest neighbor ferromagnetic coupling, a transverse field with parameter G, and a longitudinal field to break the symmetry with parameter H. And the additional terms that we had to add in order to get to an interesting case of inelastic scattering, I'm sure you could add other terms also, but we added these ones, were looked at by Paul Fenley and Ed O'Brien and Hoshi Katsura and his co-author Sanomiya previously. It maps quite nicely onto fermions, Majorana fermions. And if you just look at the model in the absence of the symmetry breaking field, the H term, the lambda term can drive you to a tricritical Ising point. So actually, I'll show you the phase diagram in a moment. Yes, importantly, there are Z2 symmetry breaking phase for a large range of lambda and G. For like non-zero lambda, this is certainly not integrable on the lattice at least. And the H term serves to break the symmetry and give us false vacua. So as promised, this is roughly what the phase diagram looks like. The Ising chain without the lambda term is the line on the bottom. And if you turn on the lambda term, well, the critical point of the Ising chain, which is over here where you get the Ising CFT, gets extended out into a line of Ising criticality. And eventually at some special value of lambda, you get a tricritical Ising point. If you then turn on the field, so this gray region is supposed to be a region with spontaneous symmetry breaking. There's a detail I didn't include here, which is that there's actually a line of product states, that the ground state is a product state for some line going roughly along here. But that's not so important right now. Anyway, but if you turn on the H field, you break the symmetry and you get false vacua. And what we did is we looked at the Ising, one case of the Ising model, or at least the data I'll present is for one particular case of the Ising chain over here, and two different cases of the non-zero lambda where we approach the tricritical point. Okay. Any questions about the model? No. Okay. So results. We saw both elastic and inelastic scattering, but let me first describe and maybe convince you that the kinks and the bubble walls we're constructing behave as you would expect them to behave. So this is a plot showing the time evolution of the spin expectation values of a kink constructed using our methods in the Ising model with the symmetry breaking field on, so with a false vacuum. And as time proceeds, this initial kink indeed accelerates in the direction of the false vacuum, which is this way. And if we look over longer times, so this is a plot of the same thing, but using colors to indicate the spin and with time on the y-axis and position on the x-axis. So you see the kink in white is stationary initially, but accelerates toward the red, the false vacuum. Now, you'll also see, as is very obvious in this plot, that it ultimately then slows down, stops again, and goes back the other way. Now, that might seem a little counterintuitive because I've been talking about how false vacuum bubble walls will accelerate eternally and approach the speed of light asymptotically, but we're on the lattice here, and that's why you don't see that behavior. There, you can't keep adding kinetic energy indefinitely and expect nothing strange to happen. So what happens? But what we can see from this plot is that the kink is stable. It doesn't decay into other particles that fly off in funny directions. It's at least stable over this amount of time evolution. And yes, you see these strange oscillations of the position, which in like condensed matter terminology are called Bloch oscillations. Why do these oscillations happen? Well, this is a plot of the dispersion relation for this topological kink excitation. And it's clearly not relativistic, is the first thing to notice. A relativistic dispersion relation looks curvy toward momentum zero, but ultimately tends toward linearity as the momentum increases. And obviously, on the lattice, the momentum is bounded. It can vary, in this case, between minus pi and pi. And so you can't have relativistic behavior. Ultimately, this dispersion relation has to turn around and become periodic. And this explains the Bloch oscillations, because the velocity of some excitation represented by such a dispersion relation corresponds to the slope of the dispersion relation. So you can just take the derivative with respect to momentum and compute the velocity for any given momentum. And if we compare that to what happens in the simulation, so in the simulation, we can measure the momentum by projecting into the basis of kink states that we constructed and then doing a Fourier transform to get a momentum. If you compare it to the momentum, you find a good matchup. So the dispersion relation and the behavior of the kink excitation in the simulation match up very nicely. And there is some maximum velocity where the gradient of this dispersion relation takes a maximum value. And after that, weird things start happening. The kink starts decelerating, stops, and eventually turns around, as we saw in the plot from before. Now, what happens to the momentum during the simulation, by the way, is it just essentially increases linearly with time. And since it's periodic, it actually just processes at a constant rate around the circle, just in case you want to connect this up with the time axis on the previous plot. So these oscillations are completely expected if you know that the dispersion relation looks like this. Now, since we want to get at the emergent relativistic dynamics of the QFT that emerges near the critical point, we don't really want to see this in our simulation. So what we do is we try to set things up so that we do not get to this maximum velocity before any collisions happen. So we choose our simulations, we choose our initial states so that we don't reach this maximum velocity. That's sort of our minimal attempt to avoid strong lattice effects. Okay.
Sorry, so what, question. So momentum would be conserved with periodic boundary conditions, but here it's not because you have to fix different boundary conditions, or it's not this?
Momentum is conserved. We were on an infinite chain. And at least in the simulation here, nothing has met the artificial walls we have separating the window where the simulation happens from the rest of the chain. So you can treat it as an infinite chain, and momentum is a good quantum number, and it's conserved.
You got slowed down. Can I, although this is a nice explanation, it's still counterintuitive that the false vacuum seems to have been stabilized, but that must be wrong. How's the false vacuum decay now?
Ah, okay, right. So why does the false vacuum just do nothing here? Yes. So our false vacuum, the matrix product state we find to represent it, is for numerical purposes an eigenstate. So it certainly doesn't decay unitarily. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have false vacuum decay. Of course, you can consider an observation that would create some true vacuum bubble, or perhaps a particle collision if you add excitations on top of the false vacuum. But at least since this is, for our practical purposes, an eigenstate, you won't see any unitary version of false vacuum decay, unless we somehow seed a bubble.
I see. But even if you create a bubble, wouldn't it expand and then oscillate?
Yes. Okay. So what we're seeing part of this here, because you can think of this simulation here as an infinitely large, the boundary of an infinitely large bubble of true vacuum, if you like. Yeah. And indeed, the wall, which we start at rest, accelerates initially towards the false vacuum, as you might expect. But then these lattice effects kick in, and it has to move backwards. That's, I suppose,
well, it's like half meson. Would it be like if I complete the picture, if I make a reflection, right, of the on the other side, then it would be like blue in the middle of two reds?
Yes. So if you were to look at the entire false vacuum bubble, if you make the bubble sufficiently large, then indeed the walls will just sort of oscillate like this, doing Bloch oscillations, and the bubble will never, up until delocalization effects, it will never collapse. Mm-hmm. Right. But that's a lattice effect. So so what we try to do is we create our bubbles small enough, or make the lattice spacing small enough, so that we don't see that happening and our bubble walls can truly meet and collide. So,
okay, thanks.
Sorry?
I was just saying thank you for that.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay, so let's look at a bubble then. So here are some simulations of actual bubbles with both a kink and an anti-kink. And this is a simulation near-ish the tricritical point in the phase diagram I showed you before. I'm showing you here two different values of the symmetry breaking field, one smaller, one larger, and the initial bubbles are otherwise the same. So they're the same, the kink and the anti-kink are the same distance apart. Now, if you keep the bubble the same and you vary the strength of the longitudinal field, that changes the rate of acceleration because it changes the energy density of the false vacuum. And so in the simulation on the left, the bubbles are moving slower when they collide than they are in the simulation on the right. And in fact, if you look at the energy of this initial state, you find that compared to the gap, which is the meson gap, on the left, it's 1.8 times the gap, so below threshold. On the right, it's 2.74 times the gap, so above threshold. And indeed, on the right, we see a production of something that looks a lot like a meson pair. So the lower plots, by the way, are energy density on a logarithmic scale, and the upper plots are the spin expectation values. So the mesons that escape ballistically from this first collision are much easier to see on the logarithmic plot of energy, obviously. And on the left, below threshold, you see that essentially you just have some slowly delocalizing bubble and no mesonic excitations flying out. Now, this does not completely rule out in elasticity, you could be producing other confined particles in this collision, and for some reason not be producing unconfined particles. But we can rule that out to good confidence using this overlap with quasi-particle basis states that I described before. So, before I get onto that though, I want to compare what we just saw with what happens if you create your initial state using a string operator and just hit that initial true vacuum state with a string. So if you just hit it with a string without smearing the string walls, you get some very sharp false vacuum bubble, and you get immediate ballistic spread of some excitations away from the bubble walls. And in this particular case, eventually you find that causality breaks down because the simulation can't stand the dynamics. Okay, so I didn't change the simulation parameters, the parameters we use, like the time step size and so on, and the bond dimension. I didn't change them for these three columns. And on the left, the dynamics just can't successfully be simulated using those parameters because of ill conditioning and large entanglement growth. And well, it's more difficult. In the middle, we smeared the walls of the string to get some focused momentum close to zero. And that helps a lot. We can actually do the simulation to reasonably long times. But you can still see, especially in the energy plot in the middle, that there are some excitations spreading ballistically from the initial state. And we don't really want those. We want to study the scattering event of the bubble walls. So if you do what we do and tune these green tensors to represent topological quasi-particles, you can eliminate that too. And the only particle production you can see, at least to this accuracy, is from the initial collision of the kink and anti-kink. The bottom row, by the way, is entanglement entropy across the cut at each lattice location.
So if we can just ask a quick question.
Yes.
So, I mean, at the top row, like in the middle and the right picture, kind of still looks like the bubble is oscillating, but this is not a lattice effect. This is just the fact that the domain walls like pass through each other, and then you have like a new bubble in the center, and that also tries to, okay.
Right, indeed. So in this simulation, I believe the bubbles get close to their maximum, sorry, the walls get close to their maximum velocity, but do not get to it before they collide. And indeed, one of the outcomes of this collision is, again, a false vacuum bubble. And that's what you see emerging. And that false vacuum bubble is a confined kink-anti-kink pair. And so they get decelerated and they slow down. And yeah, so we're not seeing Bloch oscillations in this case.
And what's the in the central like panel? What's these excitations which come from the initial like t equal to zero slice and accelerate outwards? So they turn around at like time.
Oh, they bounce off the walls. Yeah.
Okay, so there's a wall. Okay,
that's right. This is, I mean, it's not the end of the chain, but we just forbid the simulation to go outside of a certain window, and that effectively gives you a wall. It doesn't affect the simulation significantly if nothing hits it, but if something hits it, then it does. we can in principle, you can in principle just grow the window as the time proceeds, but we didn't choose to do it for these simulations.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Now I want to show you a comparison between the Ising model and this model with the lambda turned on near the tricritical point. So in the Ising model, we initially expected to see like obvious inelastic scattering when we went above threshold in terms of the energy in the Ising model. So this is the Ising model with transverse field strength 0.8. It's kind of close to the critical point, but not that close. And some longitudinal field of strength 0.007, which is roughly at the limit to where we can find a good false vacuum state. And yeah, these are the parameters for the TCI simulation. Lambda is on, it's quite close to the tricritical point. G is also very close to a tricritical point, and this is the longitudinal field in this case. So clearly one of these simulations is showing ballistic spread and the other is not. The energies are both above threshold. The Ising simulation is actually more than three times the meson mass in the Ising model. And the tricritical one is 2.62. So why do we see particle production in the tricritical case, but not in the Ising case? Well, obviously it's going to have something to do with integrability because the Ising model is only a little bit away from an integrable model. It's only 0.007 units away in terms of this longitudinal field parameter. We were at first a little puzzled by this because we did expect. Sorry, go on.
Can I just ask what is gap? Is gap twice the mass of the meson or twice the mass of the kink?
Gap is one times the mass of the meson.
One times the mass of the meson. So you start with a meson, which is okay. This is not exactly a meson, right? But it's two kinks that form a meson, right? The red thing is a meson, right?
Okay, the red thing is the red. So let me clarify the terminology. I'm using meson to refer to any excitation surrounded by true vacuum. So not only some extended thing like this false vacuum bubble, but also whatever the lowest lying scalar excitation is, where you have a green tensor and blue tensors on both sides. We're calling it a meson because presumably you can think of it as a deeply bound state of a kink and an anti-kink if you want to.
But then wouldn't we expect to see particles when we reach the mass of two or three mesons so that we can now on top of this I mean, imagine, right, a meson decaying into two, right? And the starting meson is to have enough energy to produce two excited mesons, right?
Yes, yes. Yes, exactly. So I would expect, because we're over three times the meson mass in this simulation, I would expect even to be able to produce three mesons. Okay. We could produce a pair, we could produce three.
Good. I'm used to squaring the energy.
So
the threshold is always four. Okay, sorry. Good.
Okay, good. Yes.
Three is more than two. Okay, good.
Yes, three is more than two. Yes, yeah, right.
Go on.
Right. So two is the magic number here, yes. Two is the threshold. So we were surprised that we didn't see mesons being produced in the Ising case, but you know, we kind of thought it had to have something to do with integrability. But we wanted to really make sure that we weren't seeing any signs of it. So what we did is we looked at these overlaps with these quasi-particle position states that I talked about that we would use for detecting particle content. And this is the simple case where we just try to project back onto the basis we used to construct the false vacuum bubble in the first place. So the kink anti-kink pair basis. Now, we found that if you project back onto this basis and you look at the evolution in time of this Ising simulation, that this is the blue curve, then the error in doing this projection is pretty small for the initial state. It's around 10 to the minus 5. There's some error in this for various complicated reasons I won't go into, but certainly that's a very small amplitude for not being in this kink anti-kink subspace. Then when the kink and the anti-kink collide, we leave the subspaces because there's going to be some interaction generically, and we have to, you know, discount cases where the tensors are too close together. But afterwards, when the pieces start to separate again, and the bubble reemerges in this plot here, then we see the amplitude, the error goes way back down. Maybe error is a bad word to use here. Really what I mean is the probability of not being in the kink anti-kink subspace. So if this collision were elastic, then you would expect to see something like this. You would expect to see the probability of not being in the kink anti-kink subspace to be very small after the collision, after the kink and the anti-kink are well separated again. And that does indeed seem to be what we see. The multiple curves in blue are different maximum bond dimensions. And as we increase the bond dimension and allow the ansatz to capture more of the entanglement that is produced, we get a result that's closer and closer to the initial value of around 10 to the minus 5. So this is for us good evidence that in the Ising case, this is really an elastic collision to very good approximation.
Can I ask a naive question? So here, yes. When you compute this probability, so you overlap with the meson states, right? And you see what is not in the overlap, not meson, sorry, with the kink anti-kink single particle states, right?
Yes.
And you do it at some time, right?
Yes. Yes. So you need to say,
and you need to say where they are, right, in that time. Because that's if you overlap with kink anti-kink, but if they are very far away, you get zero overlap. So you need to put them in the right place. So where do you decide where to put them? What's the criterion?
Okay. So what we do in practice is we can set it up so that these position states for kink anti-kink are orthonormal. So when the positions are different, there's no overlap between them. So they form an orthonormal position basis, if you like. And then we take the overlap with all of those states within the window of the simulation. And so that allows us to detect, respecting some minimum separation between the kink and the anti-kink in order to avoid interaction effects. And that allows us to detect a kink anti-kink pair, a well-separated one, no matter where it is within our window. And in practice, what we do something on top of that. We take some momentum dependence into account by doing a Fourier analysis and taking overlap with momentum modes of these things. But that's maybe an unnecessary detail at this point. We can detect it with this method wherever it is in the
Let me ask a similar but different question. So this is a very nice quantitative way of measuring the overlap with kink anti-kink. Another definition would be just the absolute value of the S matrix of kink anti-kink, right? When yes. the absolute value of this matrix is one, you are in the king anti king. When it's smaller Indeed. Than one, you are not. Is yes. this equal? Is this yx is the absolute value of this matrix, or it's another quantity?
I think that yes. I think this is the this is one minus the absolute value of the S matrix for a kink anti kink outcome. So well, let's see. So
Sorry.
What it is?
No, but that quantity would be a function of momentum, not a function. It will not change in time, right? So for a given momentum.
Right, right. This is integrated over momentum. This is integrated over momentum. So we, you know, we have initial wave packets with some spread of momentum, and we don't know a priori what the momenta are going to be of the outgoing wave packets. So we have to. So this is just summing over all momenta as best we can. So it's a simplified S matrix, if you like, where we just say what is the probability of being in this subspace of one kink, one anti kink.
But sorry, if I can ask a question. I mean, is that even true, like around say time of 100? Because at least as far as I understood your explanation, the reason why your plot peaks there is just because you sort of like disregard these cases where the kink anti-kink pair sits very close.
That's right. Yes.
So I guess like practically speaking, you would maybe argue that all the time you're in the kink anti-kink subspace, it's just that you disregard them around those times.
Yes. Well, in a way, right? The tricky thing is like an S matrix is defined in terms of asymptotic states, right? So that assumes that the particles are separated and do not interact. So in a way, this is the lattice version of that for wave packets. We have to have, we define our asymptotic states via this minimum separation. So maybe that helps.
No, I just think it would be really awesome if we could make contact between these very precise numerics that you have and maybe more conventional ways of measuring scattering and production in quantum field theory, like what's the S matrix? What's the absolute value of the S matrix, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
These are like, as you say, they are more averaged quantities and so on. But if you could make it a little bit more quantitative and write some equation that will say the S matrix of this model with this much magnetic field integrated over whatever should give me this much particle production. That will be very useful. That I think would be very nice to have.
Yeah, that would, I'd really like to make a connection more directly to the S matrix formalism. One thing that we did do, John looked at this and John, you helped, that we looked at in the S matrix formalism, how much entanglement would be produced in an elastic collision of two particles generically with some simple assumptions. And of course, if you just look at S matrix elements, individual elements, you wouldn't see entanglement because in 1+1 dimensions, there's only one possible elastic outcome. If you shoot in two momentum eigenstates and it's an elastic collision, you can only get one possible outgoing state. But we actually can get entanglement in these elastic collisions just because we have finite wave packets. And so we have a superposition of different momenta going in and a superposition of different momenta coming out. And so we end up producing entanglement for that reason. We wanted to quantify that. And John and Junyu did this calculation and you can see how it varies with the wave packet width. And also with a parameter of the S matrix, which determines the phase shift.
And is the case that you are studying with a vacuum and false vacuum more complicated to the Mezen's cases where there's a single vacuum? And in those Mezen cases, could you compute, make contact with the S matrix formalism? Because that would be good enough. I mean, I would be very happy to have some example where I can make contact with usual S matrix formulas and this kind of
thing. Yes. Yes, I think, I mean, it is simpler because then you don't have to deal with this this issue of differing energy densities and false vacua. It's certainly simpler. I think if you wanted to make contact, that would be the scenario to start from, yeah. Or topological particles without a symmetry breaking term, of course. I guess maybe that's one, but probably scalar particles are easier. Yeah, okay. So contrasting this behavior of the Ising model, I wanted to show you the the equivalent plot for the tricriticalizing case, the other simulation here on the right. And there we see that we are essentially in the kink anti-kink subspace until the first collision, but after the first collision, we don't go back down. We stay with some large amount of the state no longer in that subspace. So that's a strong signature of inelastic scattering. And we can be more precise about this. So what we did in this case is we tried to figure out what is being produced in the tricriticalizing simulation by taking overlap with meson-meson state, meson-meson states, two meson states, and also kink-anti-kink states where the kink need not be the lowest energy kink. So there's more than one species of kink in the system, and we found that there was some reasonable probability of having a kink of lowest energy paired with a kink of almost the lowest energy, so the next highest kink, excitation. And these plots are showing you the spin expectation values within those sectors if you were to do some measurement that projects the wave function into each of those sectors. This is what you would see in terms of spin expectation values. So you can see the two bumps from the meson pair. The 62% probability outcome of being in the same sort of state you started with, the kink-anti-kink pair of lowest energy, and the around roughly 7%. This was more difficult to determine because the kink and the anti-kink didn't separate as well as we'd like in this case, because one of the kinks is heavier. But we still got some sort of a number. We think it's around 7% for the probability of ending up in one of these states. Of course, these are still confined and they'll collapse again and another collision will happen. So I wanted to say something briefly about entanglement. So as I mentioned, entanglement is produced in both elastic and inelastic collisions with these finite wave packets. And where you have these confined particles, what you see is that up until the first collision, the entanglement is roughly constant. So the top plot is showing you the maximum cut entropy, which is just the maximum across this color plot at the bottom. The entanglement that you see initially is just the entanglement of the individual wave packet. And then at the first collision, it jumps up as there's some interaction and particles are produced. And then as the particles separate, it plateaus again. And that plateau value is roughly the value for the middle of the system. It's entanglement between the separating quasi-particles. And then, of course, because these particles, are, some of them at least, are confined, there's another collision, and there's another jump, and there's another collision, and there's another jump, and the entanglement continues to grow. And of course, if you wanted to continue to simulate this, it's going to get more or less exponentially harder as the entanglement grows linearly, roughly, with these collisions. The difficulty of doing the MPS simulation grows exponentially. Now, we also looked at the entanglement of the first collision. So just the first collision, because you might not want to simulate lots of collisions. If you just want to know what are the outcomes of that first scattering event, you only need to simulate the first collision, really. So what is the peak entanglement of that first collision as a function of energy is something we looked at. You'd like to be able to increase the energy so that you can find out what other interesting particles you can produce as you cross thresholds. So this is what we saw. Now, this takes a little explanation. The black curve, I think we should focus on first. So the black curves over here show for a point in the phase diagram quite close to the tricritical point, how the maximum entropy during the first collision scales with the initial energy of the bubble, where we vary the initial energies by changing the separation of the kink and the anti-kink. The further they are apart, the more time they have to accelerate before they collide. So you see the entanglement does increase, and indeed it seems to increase smoothly, which is kind of interesting because we're actually crossing a number of thresholds as we increase this energy. So for example, here is the magic number 4, where you might expect to suddenly see particle production involving 4 escaping mesons. And here is 3. But the entanglement entropy, the maximum entropy, still seems to increase smoothly. It does seem to, now we're not quite converged in these numbers as we get to larger energies, but it does seem to sort of slowly flatten off. This may be a lattice effect because as we increase the energy, the maximum velocity, the velocity reached by these kinks gets closer and closer to the maximum, and we get closer and closer to seeing Bloch oscillations. So this light colored curve is showing the velocity just prior to the collision. And you see it's almost plateaued as we get to the right-hand side of this plot here. So really to fully investigate this, you'd want to do some sort of continuum limit and decrease the lattice spacing so that you continue to avoid Bloch oscillations as you increase the energy. But we didn't do that yet. The red curve is the same thing, but for a point much further from criticality. So if you like, for a much coarser lattice spacing. And there we go past the point where Bloch oscillations begin and weird stuff starts to happen. Okay, so unless there are any questions on that particular part, I will close now. So I hope that I've convinced you that we can create, using this quasi-particle, topological quasi-particle ansatz, we can create stable kinks with the false vacuum on one side, and that we can observe inelastic bubble wall collisions in a modified Ising chain, and that we can at least at some level verify the particle content of the outgoing, of the state post-collision. There's sort of a trade-off that I mentioned briefly, which is you want the system size to be sufficiently large so that you can avoid lattice effects. This is one because you want the lattice spacing to be small enough that you can reach the collision energy you want to reach before encountering Bloch oscillations. Lattice spacing small means you need a big lattice to get the same stuff in. And another reason is that you want your wave packets to be sufficiently large to avoid having delocalization that makes it more difficult to tell particles apart. So we were able to simulate this particular model fairly well, and I think you could have pushed these simulations further than we did. So we are interested also in alternative models that allow us to access interesting continuum physics, but without going quite as large in the system size as we did. We went to around 1,000 sites, and NISQ devices probably won't be there for a while yet. If we can find models that have more complicated dynamics without requiring such a fine lattice spacing, then that would be very interesting. But it's, you know, it's a tricky kind of constrained problem to find interesting examples. So where do we go next? Well, we generally like to be able to increase the collision energy and see what happens and how far we can really go. We'd like to indeed try to take a continuum limit because it would be very interesting again to see how entanglement scales as you do this. Because if you're interested in the emergent continuum theory near a critical point, then a continuum limit is the thing you actually want to do. We'd like to look at harder models, possibly spin chains with higher central charges and tuning close to those critical points, because that ought to increase the complexity of the dynamics even with moderate lattice spacings, was the intuition there. And you could try to do this in higher dimensions, but that is a lot more difficult to achieve numerically, but still an interesting case to consider. And there are some cases where you, for example, might have a compactified second spatial dimension, which actually you would be able to treat with the same methods. It's interesting to consider the processes for forming true vacuum bubbles on top of the false vacuum. We did a little bit of initial experimentation with that, but there's a lot more we could do. So with that, thank you very much for your attention. I'm sorry I'm a little bit over time. Thank you very much.
All right, yeah, thanks a lot. That was a great talk. I'm sure there are many more questions. So if somebody has a question, please just unmute yourself and ask.
I mean, if Ash has time, I would like to ask a few more questions, but I think I should we should wait till the very end, and maybe
sure, yeah,
whoever
yeah.
wants to stay and discuss more informally could stay if Ash is okay with that.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Maybe let me just start by just asking a very maybe naive question. I don't know, but in constructing your kink solutions. Mm-hmm. You have your matrix product state, and then you have this one tensor you add, and you kind of obtain it by some optimization procedure.
Yes.
What would happen if I, you know, make this a bit more complicated and say, well, I have two green tensors?
Yeah. Right. What would happen? Yeah. Okay. So obviously that's kind of an arbitrary choice in some ways. We could have also chosen to use zero site tensors and just put a tensor on the bond between two sites. And as you say, we could have two sites or more. Sometimes that's a useful thing to do. I think it really depends on how well you think you're representing the quasi-particle excitation that you have, that you're targeting. So, for example, there are cases where the vacuum entanglement is very low. And there it actually turns out it's quite difficult to get a good approximation to quasi-particle excitations just using a single tensor like we did. Just because the entanglement that's present in the vacuum is what gives that tensor access to some subregion of the lattice. Right, so it can access, say, a subregion of the lattice roughly a correlation length away. But if the correlation length is very short, then that might not be enough. So you might want to include more tensors. And you can do that.
All right. All right, let me maybe stop the recording.